From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we are waiting for history to be made today, with the Senate expected to pass the largest stimulus package ever. Lawmakers fought over the details of the $2 trillion bill for days, but earlier this morning, a deal was reached to bail out big industry, small businesses, and American workers. As the COVID-19 outbreak sickens and kills Americans and seriously wounds the economy. NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales is here. Hi, Claudia.
Hi there.
So this bill calls for more than twice as much money than it was in the last big stimulus package in 2009 after the housing collapse. Of the $2 trillion, some of the money goes to companies to discourage layoffs so they have money to pay people. Other money goes directly to American families. Flesh that out. Is it a check? Who gets it?
Yes, they would get direct payments. This is an amount of $1,200. It would max out for individuals or $2,400 for married couples. It'll depend on your income level. There's also credits for children, and they will get $500 each. And yes, this is something they could see. If this gets approved this week, they could see it as early as next month.
And I know we're going to dig into this more, but are these people who are, you know, maybe fired or furloughed or out of work because their business had to close? Will this go to gig economy workers? How does it work?
This is basically everybody who is eligible depending on their income level. They say even in some cases where you don't have an income level, you could be eligible for some of these payments.
Oh, great. And what else do we know about the bill?
So there's some massive efforts in there, as you touched on. For example, there's hundreds of billions of dollars dedicated to helping loan money out to some of these industries hardest hit, such as airlines, as well as some of the smaller businesses that will be needing assistance. They also did a significant expansion of unemployment insurance. Usually you can get maybe 3 months of pay. Now they've extended that to 4 months of full pay. They also raised the weekly maximum unemployment insurance benefit by $600. And there's also significant investment for the healthcare industry, more than $150 billion there, to help hospitals, research, treatment, and also supplies, equipment. Mm. And that includes the Strategic National Stockpile, which needs an infusion of ventilators en masse. So a lot of areas they're hoping to address.
We're noting that the bill would prevent businesses controlled by the president or his family from taking advantage of the aid. That means Trump properties like his hotels and resorts aren't included. But what was the major sticking point, the major debate that they were able to pass and get through last night?
Well, there were several. The worker protections was one issue, as well as this oversight that you mentioned. They installed a Treasury Department Special Inspector General for pandemic recovery to oversee all of these loans that they hope to issue, as well as a Pandemic Response Accountability Committee to also help oversee that and prevent certain concerns of money going to boost CEO pay or help with layoffs, job cuts. And also, as you mentioned, there's a cut of that. There's a ban of that for the president. Not just the president, but the vice president, members of Congress, heads of executive departments, and their relatives also won't be able to participate in this. And I should also note that we're still awaiting the legislative text on this, so we're not clear. All of this will be in there for sure, but these are the expectations.
NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales, who will stay on this all day for you on NPR. Claudia, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's check in now on Washington State, where the earliest outbreak in the U.S. had been centered. Washington now has more than 2,400 cases and at least 123 deaths. KUOW's Carolyn Adolph joins us from Seattle. Carolyn, New York now has far more cases than Washington, but Seattle still has the second highest number of deaths in the country. It's been dealing with COVID-19 longer than anywhere else in the U.S. How do things stand right now?
Well, we're at 123 deaths on over 2,400 cases. So no sign yet of disease overwhelming our hospitals, though it's too soon to think we might be dodging a crisis. Today, it's exactly 3 weeks since office workers were sent home. And tonight, all non-essential businesses in the state will be closed by order of the governor.
Wow. Last time we spoke, you said there wasn't enough testing. You noted that New York was testing much more aggressively than Washington, despite the outbreak starting earlier in Washington. Is it easier to get tested now where you are?
Yes. An at-home testing program is launching that will allow people to test. And it's called the Seattle Coronavirus Assessment Network. The idea is to test people who feel well as people who feel sick, to get a sense finally of how the virus is operating here. And it's because of the Seattle list of partnerships. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is funding it. Amazon will deliver the test kits and pick them up. and this is backed by local health departments. It's exciting because hopefully we can get the kind of information we haven't been able to get for weeks because health officials have been rationing tests to people who are really sick.
How much strain is there now on the hospitals in the Seattle area, and what steps has the state taken to prepare for more patients coming in?
Well, the state is reporting 250 hospitalizations in the last week. We're hearing that there's a problem with supplies and that masks are in shortage. We have a local upholstery maker that's jumped on this and is producing masks. People are also trying to round up N95s, and dental offices have been largely shut and told to raid their own cupboards for gowns and masks and face shields and other items useful to hospitals. So a bit of a grassroots effort is forming as well as of the more official ones. Well, I wanted to talk about, this is the thing. There's still this preparation phase for a surge that may come, and we're starting to have tent hospitals. There's one that's going up at a soccer field just north of Seattle. Big white tent is growing there right now, and one neighbor said, wow, it reminds me of a zombie apocalypse movie. It's the only time you see a field hospital. And these hospitals are going to be dotted across the region. The county is also buying motels whenever it can as emergency housing for homeless patients. So it's a big, big effort to still ramp up to provide the surge we need.
We should note to our listeners, by the way, that I'm at home and you're at home too. So that explains the delay between the two of us as we talk to each other. Just 20 seconds here, but what's the unemployment picture right now? How's the economic impact been there in Seattle?
Oh, unemployment claims in the county, King County, where Seattle's located, have tripled. We have a huge travel industry here that is being walloped. The Alaska cruise season's on hold. That fed the hotels, some of whom have had to lay off their staffs, and I mean 200 people at a time. There's lots of tumult. However, the foundation of Seattle's economy remains technology. Amazon and Microsoft are fine.
That is KUOW's Carolyn Adolph.
Well, let's go overseas now, where the big news today is that 71-year-old Prince Charles, heir to the British throne, has tested positive for COVID-19, has mild symptoms, and is now self-isolating. In Italy, the ongoing news is the numbers of infection and deaths from COVID-19 continues to rise. The country has the highest death toll, more than 6,800, with 60,000 cases. The BBC's Mark Lowen is in Rome. And Mark, we know funerals have been banned. We've been reporting for a couple of weeks about bodies piling up at morgues. And it sounds like it's gotten worse.
It's got worse, certainly in terms of the numbers who have been killed, Robin. But the less pessimistic news is that for the third straight day, the number of total infections, that one day increase is the smallest since the outbreak began, and it is the third straight day of decline. That is important because it would suggest that the containment measures that the Italian government has put in place are now beginning to work. And if that decline continues for another 3 or 4 days, then the Italian Prime Minister and the Italian government will be able to say to people, look, your sacrifice is paying off.
Well, and that would be wonderful news. And are they? Is your sense that people are? We see pictures here of people on their balconies in packed apartment buildings, applauding the health workers or singing to each other. It appears that people in Italy are abiding by the restrictions.
They are, on the whole. The restrictions clearly are being stepped up in terms of police checks, for example. I've just been out for half the day reporting, and we ran into two police checks. They demanded the document, which allows us to justify our movement. There are far more police spot checks than there were, 4 or 5 days ago, even. And Italians, on the whole, are so aware of the gravity of this that they are willing to even tighten the restrictions further. For example, some unions in northern Italy have protested over the number of companies that are still allowed to remain open. They say that more companies should be shut down. There's very little sense of rebellion here. There's very little sense of complacency. And I have to say that in a country which is not particularly renowned in terms of its national reputation or stereotype for being that restrained or kind of, you know, following rules that closely. But on this, they are absolutely doing it.
Quick question at the end here. Here in the U.S., President Trump has been musing about churches being packed on Easter, lifting the restrictions in as little as a couple of weeks. Most health experts here say that's going to be impossible. We know in Italy, the Pope initially was telling priests to go visit people. He quickly had to withdraw that because officials were saying, we know we don't want people out visiting other people. But what are officials in Italy saying about when restrictions might be loosened there?
I think that everybody knows this is going to last for several weeks more. I mean, we are weeks away from restrictions easing. We are weeks away from schools being allowed to reopen. We are weeks away from, you know, churches here being allowed to be packed, in the words of Donald Trump. So I think that the feeling is that this is, you know, it's a wildly optimistic assertion by the US president.
The BBC's Mark Lowen in Rome. Thank you.
Pleasure, Robin.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/here now. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply. Offer valid through March 31st, 2020.
The number of coronavirus infections is now tripling every 3 days in New York City, with Boston not far behind, according to health officials. So the medical community is trying to prepare for the unimaginable. Who gets life-saving resources? Who does not? Here's New York Governor Cuomo last night.
FEMA says we're sending 400 ventilators. Really? What am I going to do with 400 ventilators when I need 30,000? You pick the 26,000 people who are going to die because you only sent 400 ventilators.
An emotional plea, to be sure, but a reasonable question. How do you decide? Who decides? Who tells the families and how? Dr. Philip Rossoff is professor emeritus at Duke University. The ethics of medical rationing is his life's work. He joins us from his home in Durham. Dr. Professor, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
And for those who are thinking, oh, that's, you know, sky is falling stuff, you and others have pointed to China and Italy where this did happen. There were shortages. Remind us.
So I think this is quite well known now that first China and now Italy and possibly other countries in Western Europe and soon possibly in the United States. I think Governor Cuomo's remarks last night were a fair warning of that to the public, that those two countries, China and Italy, were rapidly overwhelmed with extremely sick patients in advanced respiratory failure, needing mechanical ventilation, ventilators, and they had more patients than they had ventilators, healthcare personnel, and ICU beds to care for them. And they were faced with what has been called a tragic choice of patients who presumably could benefit from being on a ventilator, but there were more patients than there were ventilators, and they had to make that decision about who should get one.
Yeah, and you looked at this closely. You wrote a paper 10 years ago, and this was in the with the prospect of another pandemic and another time, and you came up with some things that you would recommend, including creating a policy open to everyone, first priority, you know, proven clinical efficacy. What does that mean?
Well, I think that this is probably a good watchword for normal times as well, as you don't want to use medical resources for people who can't benefit from them. So if you have a cold, you don't want to give somebody antibiotics that don't work in viral infections. For something like this, you want to reserve the medical capabilities that you have for those who plausibly could benefit from them. Now, that's all well and good, but what is being anticipated or what people are very, very worried about is that there will be many, many more patients who could plausibly benefit from a particular resource, in this case, ventilators, ICU beds, then we have the capability of caring for. And so how do you choose between all of the people who could be, who we could help, and narrow down the choice to those who we will help?
Yeah, I mean, you can't really do it on age. If there maybe a younger person who's sicker than an older person, I mean, the questions become intolerable. But you do say no VIPs. You know, you can't exasperate disparities. But what about when you do make those decisions? And this is something that, you know, people like you are working on. How do you tell families?
Oh, so this is. Well, first of all, let me just go back that if there are hundreds, if not thousands, of people who specialize in medical ethics and critical care medicine throughout the United States who are furiously updating plans that were sort of in storage that were created in anticipation of pandemic flu back in 2007, 8, and 9. Fortunately, we never had to use those, but they've been dusted off, they've been updated, and they're being adapted for potential use for COVID-19.
Yeah.
That being said, while we do have very good experience in hospitals that take care of critically ill patients, to talk to families, to patients and families, about bad news, if you will. We have no experience, at least to my knowledge, in telling families that you won't get your loved one or you won't get a ventilator because you lost a coin toss.
Dr. Rosoff, we're going to have you back to talk about this because it is such a compelling topic and one that we're going to be faced with. But for now, thank you for getting us thinking about it. He's with Duke University. His focus is on medical ethics. And we'll link you to his writing at hearnow.org. Dr. Rosoff, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Well, now we want to turn to President Trump's musing about opening the country again by Easter to get the economy back on its feet.
I just thought it was a beautiful time. It would be a beautiful time, a beautiful timeline.
So that was based on the data.
So his basis was on the fact that it was a beautiful time, but his own doctor, Anthony Fauci, disagreed.
You can look at a date, but you've got to be very flexible. And on a literally day-by-day and week-by-week basis, you need to evaluate the feasibility of what you're trying to do.
Who is the president listening to? Let's bring in Washington Post health policy reporter Yasmin Abutaleb. Yasmin, let's start with Dr. Fauci missing from some daily briefings, sending many to read tea leaves. The New York Times reporting Trump is losing patience with him. What are you hearing?
Right. So, you know, Dr. Fauci has sort of emerged as the spokesperson for this pandemic, the person who's sort of willing to gently correct the president in real time. Our understanding is, you know, the president knows that Dr. Fauci has unassailable credentials and is viewed as legitimate. And I think there's a recognition within the White House that you can't get rid of him. And I think he is generally respected. But the thing we found is that, you know, the president has longer relationships with sort of economic and business executives, you know, old friends from New York, some of the economic advisors within his administration. And he's more inclined to listen to them because what they're telling him, you know, to reopen things to get the economy up and running again is more in line with what he wants to hear. And what we heard from several people, you know, within the administration and close to the administration is the scientists are generally telling Trump things he doesn't really want to hear. And the president, you know, is not someone who is exactly looking for people to speak truth to power. He doesn't like bad news, even if it's the facts. So I think, you know, he's got these longer, sort of more personal relationships with the business executives who are urging him to get the market up and going again. And the scientists are still in the room. It's just, you know, it is this tug of war where they're arguing for what makes the most sense in terms of mitigating the pandemic and making sure you don't have a catastrophe on your hands if you reopen things too quickly. But him sort of feeling like every day this goes on is a day wasted towards his reelection.
Well, but you do point out that when the scientists are in the room, he does listen respectfully to them. And this is the Oval Office where, as you and your team write, there's been this sort of gladiator scene set up where people are literally fighting to get their point of view across. And yesterday in a Fox Town Hall meeting, he tried to get Dr. Deborah Birx, also from the task force meeting, she of the many scarves. he tried to get her to criticize New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, who, of course, has been very critical recently of the president and the administration for not sending him enough ventilators. Trump turned to Dr. Birx and said, "Would you blame that on the governor?" Something she had said. She ignored him. And it doesn't seem as if she's going to lose her position for that.
No, I think Dr. Birx is very well respected within the administration, and generally people are very happy she's there. And I think the president does respect Dr. Fauci and Dr. Birx. This is more that the president wants to act more in line with his instincts. You know, he doesn't really want to be dealing with this pandemic. He wants to focus on his reelection. Obviously, the strength of the economy was such a huge selling point for him. And, you know, I think there is a lot of consternation in his camp that, you know, the way the market has fallen and the unemployment numbers that we're seeing are going to really hurt his reelection, and they sort of view it as more important to get that back up to where it was to be able to tout that on the campaign trail. And what we were told is, you know, the way the process is sort of set up is you have the public health experts and the medical experts arguing their point of view, you know, from the public health perspective, and several people who have said, if you reopen the economy, that might feel good for a few days, but then you're going to pay the price when you see how the number of cases spreads and the crush of patients on the healthcare system.
And I'm going to jump in just to ask you about that, because we had Dr. Jeffrey Shaiman on yesterday. Terrific segment. He's one of the Columbia University researchers who's been crunching the data. They came up with that great modeling showing where the coronavirus could spread if there were some interventions in April, May, or June. And in all of the modeling, it showed that the less you did, and this is starting in April when the president is thinking of stopping the restrictions, there were still clusters all across the country. Not one state, he mentioned, well, out west and in these rural places, not one place doesn't have clusters. Are there Republicans speaking to him about his legacy? It's one thing for people to lose jobs. It's another thing for people to die.
I think there are some people. We know that there are some Republican lawmakers who are urging the president against this, to say you will pay the price if you prematurely do this. But I do think, you know, the people who are really bending the president's ear, and part of this is because it's in line with what he wants to hear, saying, yeah, fine, you might lose some lives, but more lives will be lost if you have extreme poverty or people out of work for extended periods of time. So there is this sort of tug of war between those two things. And the way it's set up is the public health experts firmly argue the public health point of view, the economic people firmly argue the economic point of view, and then they say it's up to the president to decide how he wants to reconcile those two things.
Yasmin Abutaleb, health policy reporter for The Washington Post, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And the health experts may be upset, but we should point out that a Gallup poll this week shows President Trump's polls the highest of his presidency.
Want to add more positivity to your podcast feed? Check out Kind World, stories of extraordinary kindness and compassion.
That's Kind World. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
Shares of Delta, American Airlines, and United Airlines were all up more than 10% this morning on news that they will soon be getting a bailout from Congress. The lifeline could not have come at a more critical time for the airline industry. According to officials, the average flight taking off right now is only 20% full, and airport traffic is down 86% from a year ago. For more, let's bring in Seth Kaplan, here and now transportation analyst. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Jeremy.
And what do we know at this point about how much the airlines are going to be getting out of this bailout from Washington?
I'm told new draft language, and this is all moving very quickly, shows $25 billion in grants for airlines, and that is to be used to pay workers through September 30th of this year. That's the deal. The passenger airlines, no layoffs through that date if they get this money. And then another up to $25 billion in loans, again, for the passenger airlines. FedEx and UPS would get a little bit aside from that. And that is what they were looking for originally. It's bounced around. There are some other conditions. No share buybacks. That's become a big issue among the public and politicians. And also no dividends into 2021.
Airlines were said to be considering halting all or at least a lot of domestic travel because so many flights are near empty right now. Does this bailout change that thinking for the airlines?
It does. And in fact, there are conditions about that, about maintaining service. And the airlines have for their part, said, look, this is not a bailout. This is disaster assistance. This is not a rainy day. This is a biblical flood. And they, from their perspective, feel like, look, the only reason they're even able to do what they're doing is because of all the things that they did before, just to put themselves in a situation where they weren't like 9/11 laying people off days later. Obviously, others feel like, look, these are companies that should have been prepared, that said they were prepared for anything, and weren't. But yeah, no, this at least does take care of the people for that period of time, and prevent some of the things that other people feel are unseemly in terms of the share buybacks and so forth.
But Seth, even with all the bailout money in the world, they still have to deal with issues like air traffic controllers, some of whom have been testing positive for COVID-19, which has shut down some control towers.
Exactly. And that's throughout. I mean, look, there are bus drivers testing positive for COVID. There are TSA workers also who come in contact with the public. And as you said, shutting down some control towers, because it's not as if you can just, even if you have a certain staffing level across the country, you just can't very quickly react to the changes. And so here we are in this situation where the service levels that are already dramatically reduced can suddenly have to be reduced further because of the virus itself impacting the workers, not just the economy and demand for air travel.
And just very quickly, do you think all the airlines are going to make it through this?
Well, they will make it for the next several months. I mean, they got what they needed to do that. And all of these airlines are in different positions in terms of if this were to go on beyond that. No, there are airlines around the world that have already failed. And there are airlines in the U.S. that would be no exception. They're just better off relatively than some around the world.
Here now, transportation analyst Seth Kaplan. Seth, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And let's get more on the federal government's response to the coronavirus pandemic. Up until January, Mark Harvey was special assistant to the president and senior director for resilience policy on the National Security Council. He's now a fellow at Harvard University's Institute of Politics. He joins us now. Mark, welcome back. And let me start with what the president said yesterday, which is that he wants to reopen the economy by Easter. That is right when many doctors and scientists predict the outbreak could be at a peak in the U.S., that we could be seeing something like what they're seeing in Italy right now. Do you think the administration is more focused right now on calming financial markets and the economy than responding to the public health threat?
I think the most important thing is the public health threat and the long-term strategy to be able to address that. Recall that our strategy here as a nation is to keep the healthcare system from becoming overwhelmed until a vaccine or a treatment can be developed and widely deployed. And in order to do that, we've all heard about flattening the curve. We also have to remember that flattening the curve also means lengthening the curve. So keeping these measures in place and looking at where targeted activity can continue to take place if the risk allows for it is a better strategy rather than creating a generic goal to try to get everything back based on a timetable instead of based on quality measures of public health that allow us to know when it's safe for people to go back to normal business.
So what did you think when the president said Easter?
I think Easter's an aggressive time frame. I think that we cannot focus our scale back of social distancing measures uniquely on time. It really does need to be informed by good data. It's very interesting that this is the first pandemic that's unfolded in both the social media era and the era of big data analytics. And we haven't really seen either of those brought to great utility in combating this pandemic at this point. So what I'm looking for in order to allow us to know what we can or when we can actually go back to normal are measures like the rate of influenza-like and respiratory illnesses presenting at emergency room departments. We need to understand the capacity of hospitals and how many beds are currently available. And those are the types of measures that we can start to look at in terms of days instead of weeks, but also remember that this is going to be something lasting for a period of multiple weeks. And we need to start managing the impacts in weeks to months ahead.
Well, and one of the things that the data are telling us at this point is that New York has more than half of the cases in the country. We know that many people have been leaving the New York area, maybe asymptomatic, and taking the disease with them wherever they go. Are you looking at the data that's available now and saying this crisis is going to peak again in a few weeks because of all the people who have been moving around during this period of the last couple weeks?
I think the data that we see is that we won't see one peak to this curve, but we'll probably see multiple peaks. But hopefully those ones in the future are much smaller than the ones that we're about to experience over the course of the next 2 weeks or so because of all the strong measures that are being put in place around the country. Definitely recognize that travel is a major risk, and I applaud the White House yesterday for saying that people that recently left New York should self-isolate for a period of 14 days and continue to monitor their potential symptoms because of the likelihood for them to be asymptomatic but still carry the disease. This virus, as we learn more about it, has really proven to kind of be the Goldilocks virus in terms of its ability to be transmitted, but also in terms of how dangerous it is, especially for more vulnerable populations.
Do you think the government should go further in restricting the movement of people, restricting domestic travel in order to try to contain this virus?
That's really something that needs to be balanced with measures that are being taken across the country right now. I think the first step is to be able to see whether or not the strong social distancing is having an impact. And unfortunately, we just don't have data from that. It's still a little bit too early. In the meantime, what they need to be looking toward is not just how we're managing what's happening today, but what is going to be happening months from now. And really, I would recommend that the administration be looking strongly towards some prioritization of some of those infrastructure sectors for investment and protective measures over the next couple of months to make sure that we don't end up with broad cascading impacts from this pandemic.
In your time on the National Security Council, did you consider the issues that are unique to New York City and a dense place like New York City, where even the most aggressive social distancing might not be enough in a pandemic like this?
We did, and this falls into a category of broadly what's called non-pharmaceutical intervention. And it's not enough alone just to do social distancing in certain communities. It also needs to be combined with strong antivirals, strong education campaigns, use of novel treatment capabilities. All of those things combined are what typically help to flatten that curve and be able to treat what's happening with pandemic. The other thing that we have to look at in terms of emergency planning is an ability to start to bring in excess capacity. Frankly, that's where New York is right now. And if we start to see cases fill up those hospital beds and for a longer period of time than they have the capacity for, that's where these temporary measures need to be put into place. That's also one of the reasons why each state handling this alone individually is not a recipe for success. We need to be able as a nation to surge resources to where they are needed and be able to watch those measures for where those resources may be needed next. So I'm very concerned right now about some of the reports from Louisiana and Texas about a potential rise in cases there, because we'll know the more places that we have to surge resources, the thinner will be spread.
Well, shouldn't the administration have been better prepared for this, though? We've known about this virus since December of last year. That is a lot of time that could have been spent getting ventilators built and ready to be sent out to these places that are going to need them very quickly.
So we have known about the virus since late last year, but understanding the virus and being able to characterize it and its impact on specific populations has been evolving even as we go along. We continue to learn more about it over recent weeks. So it is very tough to be able to adequately prepare and pull the trigger on those decisions without a lot of that information. I think some of the early information that came in and early information that I saw when I was still there basically looked like a bit more severe version of the flu. And what we knew from previous SARS outbreaks is that SARS was not as transmissible as flu. So a lot of those assumptions were baked in to understanding the disease as it went on. And as I said earlier, this one seems to have mutated just enough to really hit that sweet spot of being highly transmissible, but still relatively severe. And that's a unique challenge. So not driving in the rearview mirror at this point, it needs to be, push the pedal to the metal on trying to get the production capacity ramped up for our ability to treat the public health system. But we also need to be looking down the road at some of the other critical sectors that are out there. What's going to happen with our food and agriculture industry? What's going to happen with critical manufacturing? What's going to happen with transportation? And also, very importantly, what's going to happen with the November elections if we do need to go to something like mail-in ballots across the country?
Do you think it is time for the president to start using the Defense Production Act in order to make manufacturers make up the shortfall in anticipated demand for things like ventilators, masks, and other critical medical equipment?
Absolutely. And I would also take a look at expanding that across some of the other critical infrastructure that would be necessary as we go forward. The short-term and mid-term need is going to be for the healthcare and public health system. But we also need to understand the supply chain disruptions that are continuing to happen and how those will end up impacting our manufacturing capacity and our ability to carry out a lot of the key functions of day-to-day life.
That is Mark Harvey, former special assistant to President Trump and senior director for resilience policy on the National Security Council. He's now a fellow at Harvard University's Institute of Politics. Mark Harvey, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me back.
And one of the things Mark Harvey told us he's worried about is the nation's food supply. He said about one-fifth of farm workers in the U.S. are migrants, most if not all of whom are stuck in Mexico right now, with planting season for some produce already underway. We will continue to follow that story.
So you say you're cooped up at home because of the coronavirus? Look out the window. Or if you can, go for a walk, keeping your social distance, of course. And look up. Birds are migrating. Let's check in on migration with Richard Gibbons, conservation director at Houston Audubon and a research associate of the Louisiana State Museum of Natural Science. And let's bring up that bird sound first. Richard, where have you taken us and what are you seeing?
All right, I've taken you to my favorite place in High Island, Texas, which is this 25-foot hill of wooded area in the middle of a sea of marsh. And in the middle of that woods is a pond, and in the middle of that pond is an island with hundreds of birds that are nesting. We're hearing the jostling of great egrets coming in to their nests that are under construction, or their mate is brooding eggs already. The snowy egrets have just shown up in the last week, and they're making this really cool gurgling sound, like, and then the spoonbills as well. They're all looking for nesting material and trying to keep the great egrets at bay.
Well, and, remind people how this works. Do birds really, when they're migrating, they look down and they go, oh, there's that great place that we love? We know they have memories, but how does this work?
Migration is an extremely complicated phenomenon, and it is driven by the need to have successful breeding. So when something's that critically important to your survival and the survival of a species, redundancy is a really good thing. So yes, you do have dead reckoning where you look down and say, hey, I remember that patch. That's where we were last year. That's home.
Hmm. So how is climate change? A lot of people are concerned that because of the coronavirus, a crisis in and of itself, it shoved another crisis off the front pages, which is climate change. One of the promises of global warming and climate change was more viruses, more disease. But for now, we're not really thinking about climate change as much. Are you seeing birds migrating in a different way because of changing climate?
It is a great question, and it is helpful to think about bird migration in two major categories. You have many species that are taking their migratory cues from their environment. So temperature, green up, which is when leaf out happens and everything springs to life. And the insects start, they start saying, oh, there's fresh leaves to eat and there's fruit to eat. And it's time for me to go. I get this Zugenruhe, this migratory restlessness.
Zugen, what was that word?
Zugenruhe.
Okay.
Sorry. It's a German word for migratory restlessness. Climate change is, it is definitely having an effect. And so we have the two groups of birds. You have these weather migrants that are taking their cues from the weather. And then you have what are called calendar migrants, which take their main migratory cues from day length. So if you're on the other side of the equator or way down in another, you know, in another part of Central America, you don't know when things are greening up here. Purple martins are back now in North America. And when they were down in Brazil, the day length started switching. It reached a point and they said, it's time to go. Those birds are arriving in North America now, the first waves, and things are a little further advanced. So think of those migrants that are cued by day length. They are getting here, and it's like their dinner reservation is a little too late. Mm-hmm. And those birds that get there too early, they may be punished with a late freeze. And if they get there too late, they won't find a territory. Hmm. I'm sorry, I'm being interrupted by a tree frog.
I hate when they do that.
I know.
Yeah, but your point is they are affected by climate change. Look, I know, I looked up in my backyard the other day. Oh, my gosh, a woodpecker, the little black and white feathered with the red crown on top. Oh, my, took my breath away. Rounded a corner coming down the driveway. I live in a city. You know, came down the driveway, and there's a hawk. And it wasn't red-tailed. It looked like a, you know, maybe a Cooper's hawk. I looked it up. You know, I guess just people should just look. It's so calming.
You know, these are very, very strange times. And we're all trying to find a balance between being informed and also staying sane. For many people, such a small dose of nature can help center them. You know, life is going on all around us, and nature's a great teacher.
Well, Richard Gibbons, thank you so much. We needed this. Richard, conservation director at Houston Audubon. He's also a research associate at the Louisiana State University Museum of Natural Science. And by the way, they also have a camera at Bolivar Flats Shore Bird Sanctuary. We'll link you up at hereandnow.org. What a wonderful, I can't wait. Richard, thank you so much for taking us there. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Okay, I want more birds. Oh, there's a woodpecker. Aren't you calmer? Jeremy, aren't you calmer?
I will tell you that my dog Midas, who's sitting next to me, is much more interested in the birds than the news.
And he's much calmer.
Exactly.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.